Today is July the 20th, 2022, a historic moment in the history of mankind. 63 years earlier, on this date, July 20th, 1969, Apollo 11 successfully made the first man landing on the moon in the Sea of Tranquility. American astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin would become the first humans to walk on the moon almost 7 hours after touching down. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. That's PRN.live, L-I-V-E, streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is also available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Amazon can give Ring footage to cops without your permission or even a warrant. Despite what you might think or were told, your Amazon Ring camera might be giving video data to police without your knowledge or consent. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey had noted that last week during Amazon's Prime Day event that Amazon admitted to sending footage to police without a court order or user's permission 11 times this year alone. While the number is relatively small, this is also the first time the company has said that it released data this way, according to Politico. It's also a reminder that if your data is out there and under the control of someone else, and in this case Amazon, you have little or no say over whether law enforcement gets it. Markey has been concerned about Ring's partnership with law enforcement and privacy issues for years. It has become increasingly difficult for the public to move, assemble, and converse in public without being tracked and recorded. Concerns are not unfounded. Amazon's partnership with law enforcement agencies, which gives them access to its portal to request user data, has greatly expanded since its inception. There were 405 police departments in the program in August of 2019. Today, there are 2,161. But the police's access pales in comparison to Amazon's. The company also has vast sets of data on what we buy and where we live, and has a burgeoning ad business that uses your data to target ads to you on Amazon and beyond. The company also recently rolled out Amazon Sidewalk, a controversial service that connects certain Echo and Ring devices to each other, unless the user opts out. It all adds up to a massive and powerful conglomerate that knows more about many of us than just about any other company, including who's on our doorsteps or strolling past our homes. The Ring camera footage was sent in response to emergency requests, which are supposed to be made only when there's a belief that serious harm or death will result if the footage isn't released immediately. Police request the data, but it's up to Amazon to decide whether to release the footage as well as if the request is legitimate. Bloomberg News recently revealed that people pretending to be law enforcement have been able to trick companies, including Meta, Apple, and Google, into giving them data this way. There will always be reasons why, in emergency situations, authorities might seek live access to cameras, but people have the right to be skeptical when police and Ring, behind closed doors, get to decide what reasons meet a threshold of an emergency and allow police to get warrantless access to their personal devices. Electronic Frontier Foundation recommended that users turn on Ring's end-to-end encryption feature if they're concerned about police having unfettered access to their data. Ring says in its law enforcement guidelines, which are buried in its support documents, that it may send footage to law enforcement in case of emergencies. Ring also sends user data and footage to law enforcement in response to court orders, as does every company that has data for police to get. Amazon recently revealed that it received more than 3,100 legal demands for data in 2021, an increase of 65% from the year before. The reports did not say how many of those demands the company provide responses to. While Ring says it tells users if law enforcement requests their information, it may be legally prohibited from doing so. Users were only notified of about 648 requests. Amazon also said that while customers have the option of turning audio recording off during video recording, it would not make that the default because customers may never look at their settings to know to turn it on, which, by extension, means many customers don't look at their settings to know that audio can be turned off. The company also told Senator Markey that Ring does not currently offer voice recognition. That's not a commitment to never offer it in the future, which Markey had asked for. Increasing law enforcement reliance on private surveillance creates a crisis of accountability. And we should be particularly concerned that biometric surveillance could become central to the growing web of surveillance systems that Amazon and other powerful tech companies are responsible for. Ring spokesperson Brendan Daly said that Ring doesn't offer unfettered access to customer data to anyone, including law enforcement. The law authorizes companies like Ring to provide information to government entities if the company believes that an emergency involving danger of death or serious physical injury to any person, such as a kidnapping or an attempted murder, requires disclosure without delay. The spokesperson also added that Ring faithfully applies that legal standard. For years, Amazon has talked up its Ring Smart Doorbell and security system partnership with police departments across the country. Although privacy advocates worry that Amazon was creating its own national surveillance network, Amazon maintained that Ring was a way for customers to feel more safe and secure in their own homes. And while Amazon offered police departments a portal through which they could access users' Ring's device footage when they deem necessary, the company assured users that police could only get that footage with the user's knowledge and permission. That's never been entirely true, as the company's letter to Markey made more apparent than ever. Legislators and regulators have tried to rein Amazon in, but there seems to be significant limits to what they can actually do and how effective those measures will be. If the government and agencies won't or can't protect consumers' privacy, Amazon gets to decide how and when to do so, and its business interests are in the data it collects and uses, and that leaves it to the consumer to decide if giving their data up to Amazon is worth the convenience of the products and services it sells in exchange. After 48 years, CPM is now free license to use. CPM, originally standing for Control Program for Monitor, and later Control Program for Microcomputers, was a mass market operating system created in 1974 for Intel 8085-based microcomputers by Gary Kildall of Digital Research, initially confined to single-tasking on 8-bit processors. WordStar was one of the first widely used word processors, and DBase, an early and popular database program for microcomputers, were originally written for CPM. Although graphics-capable S100 systems existed from the commercialization of the S100 bus, CPM did not provide any standardized graphics. Before Microsoft and Intel dominated the PC market with a common platform, the CPM operating system did something similar for small business machines in the late 1970s and early 1980s. CPM was a text-based operating system created by programmer Gary Kildall of Digital Research in 1974. Its initials stood for Control Program / Monitor at first, but Digital Research changed it to the more friendly Control Program for Microcomputers. As for the price of microcomputers dropped rapidly in the mid-late 1970s, CPM paired with the Z80 CPU became a de facto standard platform that was popular among small business computers in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Popular applications for CPM included WordStar, a word processor, SuperCalc, a spreadsheet application, and DBase for databases. Other programs such as AutoCAD and Turbo Pascal originated on CPM, and later became more successful after being ported to MS-DOS later. When IBM began developing its personal computer, the IBM PC 5150, the firm first tried to secure license to CPM, but Digital Research didn't like the proposed terms of the deal, so IBM turned to Microsoft, which licensed a product called 86DOS from Seattle Computer Products, and some months later, Microsoft purchased 86DOS outright for $50,000. 86DOS became IBM PC-DOS when it shipped with the IBM PC in August of 1981. Later, Microsoft would sell PC-DOS under its own label as Microsoft MS-DOS. While developing 86DOS, its creator, Tim Patterson, looked heavily to CPM for inspiration, borrowing its general architecture and command line nature. And a list of similarities existed between CPM and MS-DOS. Its source has been available in some form with a few strings attached for a long time now, but now we have confirmation from Digital Research's successor company that is now available without restrictions. For years, it was something, an operating system that had been bypassed by the hardware and hacker communities. The company that still owns Digital Research's CPM operating system has granted a new, more permissive license for the 8-bit OS, making it free for anyone to modify or redistribute. Brian Sparks, then CEO of Caldera spinoff Linio, and Linio in turn spun off DRDOS, which ended up owning the Digital Research intellectual property. That company's still around, and Mr. Spark is its president. This month, retired programmer Scott Chapman managed to contact Sparks and request clarification of whether anyone else was allowed to redistribute CPM, and Sparks has granted free rein. You can now legally run the raw, unbridled power of CPM version 2.2 any way you like. The Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California, makes several versions of it available. CPM first appeared in 1974, only 1 year after the first version of Unix written in C. The difference is that even then, Unix was rather complex, whereas CPM is tiny. The first versions of CPM was written in a combination of assembly language and Gary Kildor's homegrown PL/M. The PL/M language incorporated ideas from PL/1, Algol, and XPL, and had an integrated macro processor. The PLM programming language, which is an acronym of Programming Language for Microcomputers, is a high-level language conceived and developed by Gary Kildor in 1973 for Intel microprocessors. PLM was the first high-level programming language for microprocessor-based computers and was the original implementation language for those parts of the CPM operating system which were not written in assembler. Many Intel and Zilog Z80-based embedded systems were programmed in PLM during the 1970s and 1980s. Microsoft will return to releasing new Windows versions once every 3 years. Microsoft is planning yet another big change to the way it updates Windows, according to a report from Windows Central. Rather than updating a single version of Windows for many years as it did with Windows 10, Microsoft plans to return to a schedule where it releases a new major version of Windows roughly once every 3 years, putting a hypothetical Windows 12 on track for release at some point in the fall of 2024. On the surface, this looked a lot like a return to the pre-Windows 10 days. But the report says that Microsoft will continue to refine the current Windows release at a steady clip, with new feature drops, internally called moments, planned roughly once per quarter. We've already gotten a taste of that with Windows 11, which has evolved steadily throughout the year. Windows Central reports that the big yearly update model could be going away for good. Whatever the company's planning, it's not ready to announce it to the public right now. That leaves a bunch of big questions unanswered. Will Windows 12 be a paid upgrade like older Windows versions, or will it be free to current Windows users like Windows 10 and Windows 11? What features, if any, will be maintained across multiple major Windows releases? What kind of features are included in Moments, and which are held back for major releases? The benefits to returning to more clearly delineated Windows releases enables Microsoft to change hardware system requirements, ensuring that any system running Windows 12 has more capable hardware than the one that runs Windows 11. For third-party developers and IT administrators, the current plan sounds like a continually shifting current version of Windows that's always being tweaked, plus a more fragmented install base with big groups of users running one of three or four different Windows versions with different user interfaces and feature sets. With many companies, hardware replacement is done in stages, with equipment being trickled down the organization. If you think there is a semiconductor shortage, the United States has another potential shortage, electronics engineers. While the global chip shortage shows some signs of subsiding, semiconductor companies are facing another area where demand outpaces supply, microelectronics engineers. This concern was illustrated from Intel during a recent panel on the subject at the annual VLSI Symposium on Technology and Circuits last month. How U.S. college enrollment for computer science majors have risen over the past three decades, while electrical engineering majors have plummeted. Chipmakers like Intel, Taiwan Semiconductor, and Samsung are all trying to expand their manufacturing capacity with the goals of supporting future growth and making supply chains more resilient. Simply put, industry growth can't happen if there aren't enough engineers to design, fabricate, and verify the chips, among the other roles needed. Intel is building fabs or factories in Arizona, Ohio, and Germany. The semiconductor giant expects to create 3,000 high-tech jobs at each of these sites, at least in the first phase of the projects. That means Intel needs to find 6,000 people to fill those roles in the United States and 3,000 to take up those positions in Germany by the time these fabs go online in a few years. Taiwan Semiconductor, on the other hand, will need to find 1,600 capable people for high-tech jobs at the chipmaker's advanced fab in Arizona that is currently under construction. In Texas, Samsung will need to match more than 2,000 people with high-tech positions for its factory that is set to open in 2024. Other chipmakers like GlobalFoundries are building new fabs too in the United States and elsewhere. And these figures don't include all the job openings for microelectronics engineers in non-manufacturing roles, such as chip architects and HDL engineers, particularly when considering firms like NVIDIA, Qualcomm, and AMD that only focus on chip design. Moreover, these numbers don't touch upon the wider ecosystem of companies that the industry relies on, like suppliers and design tool vendors, which means the talent needs will be even greater. Some of these roles, such as design tooling and fabrication, can be filled by computer science and physics graduates and people with similar education, but the gap between computer science and electronics engineering is stark. Other countries are gearing up for massive semiconductor hiring sprees, too. This includes Japan, which needs roughly 35,000 engineers in the next decade to keep up with the government's push to grow the country's semiconductor sector, according to a national industry body. There are efforts underway to build interest and educate a new generation of engineers to fill the incoming wave of openings. Intel, for instance, to spend $100 million to improve semiconductor education and research in the United States, and half of that money will go towards trying to line up enough people to work at Intel's manufacturing site in Ohio. But the semiconductor industry still faces big obstacles in ensuring companies can get the engineers they need over the next several years. One of the problems is that chip houses aren't as flashy as big tech companies like Apple, Google, and other household names. This is compounded by the issue that software jobs have a reputation for paying more than hardware jobs out of college. If hardware jobs can't pay more, it means the industry needs to find other ways to make the industry more appealing. The panelists at the symposium also highlighted the need to improve the experience for interns and first-timers in the industry. Potential solutions included offering more opportunities to interact with higher-ups on-site and changing the perception of roles often viewed as non-glamorous, such as verification. Then there's a question of whether the industry is thinking about the problem correctly in the first place. On Twitter, Googler John Masters, who is working on custom compute designs at the web giant, said the bigger issue is the way companies keep hardware people separate from software people. There is unemployment, while at the same time there's demand for workers. Unlike what our President Joe Biden had suggested at one time, that coal miners could simply learn to code to transition to jobs of the future. Job skills are not necessarily interchangeable from one job to another job. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell. Remote work made some people less suitable for office.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we spend some time talking about, yes, you and your workplace, as well as IT and how this all fits in together. Most of what I'm going to talk about for the next few minutes is less IT and more about you. There is this idea that in the news, in the media, that they should be dismissing this whole entire work at home, work from home concept as being unprofessional. And the naysayers are out there, and a lot of different industries are feeding into this. I don't have proof of conspiracy, but it's kind of funny how there's a lot of people who are screaming on both sides. Oh, we should never have to return to the office. Oh, everybody needs to return to the office. They'll be far more productive. And back and forth. But you know what? There is a kernel of truth to some of the problems that have been reported in that effort to move us back into the office. Personal hygiene. This should come as no surprise to anybody. Whether we're talking about standard grooming, or really one of the big facts is many people no longer have the same sized body and wardrobe to go with it as they did 2 years ago. I will tell you, a lot of people put on weight. A lot of people are struggling to fit into the clothing that they wore 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. I'm on the other end. I've lost a good chunk of weight. Not as much as I wanted to, but I've made some serious headway there. So my clothing is actually quite a bit loose. I am down roughly about 7 inches in my girth, in my belly. So my clothing is quite loose. But I'm not a customer-facing individual. I'm not going to flunk a dress code, but there are people who will. So you need to think about that. You need to reflect that in the back of your mind. One of the things I would also suggest is look at your wardrobe. and how it's changed and look at what these styles are and decide to set upon something that is simple, repeatable, and also mix and match. This is kind of the world we've arrived in. There's a lot more comfort that's there, but you need to kind of find your world with this. Reach out. This is something I would suggest to anybody. If you are customer facing, reach out to somebody to help you with your wardrobe. We kind of look beyond, we're not capable of seeing our own faults in our wardrobes. Now, here's some other problems that have come along with this. And this is the increase of casual behavior. Now, we went through and we did a lot of short text messages, and we had the ability to disappear for way too long. We could step away from our computer and we'd get back to the computer, and I know people engaged in little white lies. Oh yeah, you couldn't reach me because I was in the restroom, or I was dealing with somebody who had this major problem. That's kind of funny because I was reaching out to you because they had this problem and they couldn't reach you. I mean, we know that there's a lot of these things going on. And look, I get it. You know, it's not exactly like you're taking a nap, or is it? Yes, we do know that people have indulged in some less than normal work behaviors. They were out of sight, out of mind. So yes, some people did take some short naps. Some people did do an increase in imbibing alcohol. And we also found that yes, some people did go through and did an increase in their casual personal usage of IT resources. So all of these things kind of tie in. All of these different areas do have some link into technology, and it's unfortunate. And we have to get back in our game. We've got to be more professional. This is one of the things that I've known all the way along. I have worked from home, worked from anywhere before. It wasn't exactly a keen experience, but it was because it was who I was working for and some of the experiences that I had with the work from home experience before. The latest has been actually quite good, and I've turned into a stellar example, or at least that's what I think, in the office. One other area, and this is a tough one. Mental health has been dismissed as we spoke less. We didn't see people. We didn't get good reads on people and how they were doing. We have had a suffering in the communications abilities. So people are having to relearn those visual cues that go along with the words, or rather that don't go along with the words. We've had to go through, and as we're moving back into the office, we have to start thinking about how we're presenting. We've been forced introverts for a while. We've been no longer engaging with somebody's face, but with our own face, with the camera, with what we see on Zoom, and making sure we're presentable, and other things on the screen, not necessarily looking at other people. So we have to weigh that out. We have to think about this, and we have to process this. So these are not so much problems as different little burdens, little barriers, little hurdles that we're going to have to overcome, that we're going to have to solve in the coming weeks, months, years, as we change with, of course, the workplace. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The next generation in television broadcasting. In the early days of television, all signals were transmitted over the air. Those who weren't close enough to the broadcast station or lived in mountainous areas where the signals would be disrupted could not access the signals and were left without television. Despite its popularity and reliability for decades, analog televisions are known to have a number of problems. These problems may relate to issues like ghosting and snow. The signal may also degrade if the distance of the TV from the station is long or there are buildings or objects in between the transmission. We didn't begin to see cable television as we know today until the late 1970s. When television broadcasting got its start in the United States in the 1940s, the broadcast networks carried TV programs exclusively over the airwaves. They built tall towers that broadcast audio and video signals through the air to surrounding areas. Viewers used antennas on rooftops or attached to television sets to receive the signals. The main problem with this system of television transmission was that the signals grew weaker as they traveled further from the towers. In addition, TV networks tended to concentrate their operations in heavily populated urban areas where their signals would reach the largest number of viewers. As a result, millions of Americans living in rural areas found themselves with either poor TV reception or no access to broadcast television signals at all. The FCC in 1972 issued Cable Television Report and Order that allowed cable operators to bring in distant television signals. The reduction in FCC regulations led to tremendous growth in cable TV systems. These new networks no longer simply delivered programs that aired on the broadcast networks. Instead, they came up with unique programs and services, often targeted towards specific narrow audience groups. As cable television continued to grow into more areas of the United States, more and more specialized channels were launched. What started as a modest cost for cable television subscription today has ballooned to extraordinarily high cable subscription expense. Content providers are now requiring the cable providers to accept all of their content offerings. There is an average of 187 channels offered through cable TV that go unwatched. The average cable subscriber only watches 17 out of 200 channels in their cable package, but the cable subscribers have to pay for the unwatched channels. There isn't competition with cable providers as local communities franchise the operation to cable providers. A review of publicly available data by DecisionData.org found the average cable package costs $217.42 per month in just New York City. That's more than many households pay for other utilities combined, according to the website. It also notes that cable package prices are similar regardless of the size of a household. According to eMarketer, the cable industry in the United States has seen its customer ranks whittled down from more than 100 million households as recently as 2014 to roughly 74 million now. That's quite troubling. Yet, it's a trend that's yet to run its full course. Cord cutting is accelerating. Cable subscribers are canceling their subscriptions to multi-channel television services available over cable or satellite, dropping pay television channels, or reducing the number of hours of subscription TV viewed in response to competition from rival media available over the internet. This content is either free or significantly cheaper than the same content provided via cable. In addition to cord cutting, there is now television broadcasting the old-fashioned way, over the airwaves, but with modern technology enabling the delivery of 4K HDR picture with better sound and better over-the-air video with HDR, with the advantage of digital television over analog television, a clean transmission signal is available. ATSC 3.0 is a new standard that will bring a long list of new features to over-the-air TV. Two main features that will really excite cord cutters are 4K HDR picture with better sound and better over-the-air TV coverage. There are other great features such as detailed custom weather alerts, internet active news stories, and more. And you will not need a new antenna. An antenna is a dumb device that picks up all signals out there, FM, AM, TV, and so on. The chips in your TV decode the signals and display the images, just like how a 40-year-old antenna in your attic or on top of the roof still work with a new digital TV, today's antenna will work with 3.0 TV. You do not need internet to use 3.0 over-the-air TV. The new 3.0 over-the-air does have some similarities to home internet in a way it transmits data, but it is not internet and you do not need internet. TV viewers in the United States may not be aware of it, but there's a new digital TV broadcasting standard coming your way. In fact, ATSC 3.0, now better known as Next Generation TV, might have already arrived in 4K quality video with HDR, which is high dynamic range, among other features and capabilities. Next Gen TV, formerly known as ATSC 3.0, is a new kid in town with over-the-air broadcasting standards. With endless subscription TV services and even higher cable satellite bills, new television technology is rolling out in which you can be watching up to 4K TV for free. Some TV, anyway. This advancement is called Next Gen TV, and it's rolling out nationwide. In fact, it's already available in most major U.S. cities. Many new TVs have compatible tuners built in, and there are a growing number of standalone tuners available. As the name suggests, this is the next generation of over-the-air broadcasts, replacing or supplementing the free high-definition broadcasts we've had for over two decades. Standout features of next-gen, like 4K and HDR, aren't yet widely available, but the picture quality of full high-def image will likely look better than what you're used to from streaming or even cable satellite. What is next-gen TV? Next-gen TV offers a variety of new technologies, including the ability to broadcast 4K, HDR, and more, and because of how it works, you'll likely get better reception if you're far from the TV tower. The short version is, next-gen is free, over-the-air television, with potentially more channels and better image quality than older over-the-air broadcasters. Where is next-gen TV now? Most major cities carry next-gen TV stations, as do a lot of smaller ones, with more rolling out every month. The transition to next-gen is voluntary, but so far many stations in most markets are embracing the change. A lot of that has to do with groundwork that was laid during the digital transition to HDTV. Since everything is digital already, upgrading to next-gen doesn't have the same high cost that switching from analog NTSC to digital ATSC 1.0 did. There are also new ways stations can make money, which certainly softens the blow. You can find out what stations are already active in your area at, and this is the following URL, watchnextgentv.com, one word, watchnextgentv.com/markets. What do you need for next-gen TV? All you need is a next-gen tuner and an antenna. If you're shopping for a new TV, many current models have built-in next-gen TV tuners. This includes many models from LG, Sony, Hisense, and Samsung. There are a handful of external tuners as well. The antenna part is fairly easy. There are a lot of inexpensive options, and if you already have an antenna from the HDTV days, it will likely work just fine. Will it have your favorite show? Well, that is the $64 question. What good is free content if it's not content you want to watch? Next Gen is a broadcast standard that typically covers the broadcasters of what you're familiar with, mainstream, ABC, CBS, Fox, NBC, and PBS. These aren't the only channels you'll find, but these will be the core offerings in most areas. The specifics, however, are more complex. Not every station in your area will have converted to Next Gen. Though conveniently, if you have the antenna and tuner, you should be able to get all the ATSC 1.0, also known as old school HDTV broadcasts. So you should be able to get all the major broadcasters for free, over the air, one way or another. In many areas, however, you'll be able to get much more than those. Most stations run multiple sub-channels, which in turn run different programming under the same channel banner, plus they are smaller broadcasters with varied content. Content material on NextGen will vary in different parts of the country. This is a frustrating maybe. The technology behind NextGen allows it to be quite flexible. If you think about your home's internet connection as a two-way data pipe, NextGen is sending out huge amounts of data one way, everywhere, constantly. With NextGen, local stations have a lot more options for what they can broadcast, and that includes 4K and HDR. However, you need something to broadcast. Unlike streaming services, major networks have little motivation to upgrade the image quality of their content. Some sporting events have had some 4K cameras, but the rollout is frustratingly slow. Without the networks offering shows in 4K, next-gen channels have little, if any, 4K content to show. Will that change almost certainly? Will it change tomorrow? No. That said, you might be surprised at how good 1080p can look, especially compared to the highly compressed 4K we've all been watching via streaming. Does this mean I need to watch ads again? Hey, you gotta realize nothing in life is ever truly free. In this case, you pay with your time by watching ads. Back in the olden days, also known as before streaming, there were things called DVRs that recorded programming to a hard drive for later watching. You could fast forward through the commercials. It was a thing, and it still is if you pay for cable or satellite TV. A major effort is now underway to launch next-gen TV service in New York City and surrounding areas, the number one television market in the country's encompassing approximately 7.5 million TV households, according to the 2021 Nielsen rankings. The WNET Group's WLIW21 will serve as the host station for ATSC 3.0 broadcasts for the three major PBS member stations in the New York metropolitan area. Channel 13, WLIW, which is Channel 21, and New Jersey PBS. WLIW21 plans to sign on with next-gen TV signals following extensive engineering testing and operational planning, co-location of its broadcast facilities in the One World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan. As of this summer, ATSC 3.0 is available in 68 markets, reaching half of all U.S. homes, according to the FCC. The commission also noted that at least one full-power TV station has been licensed to provide ATSC 3.0 services in 54 designated market areas. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston, Single Chip Radar.
Marty Winston joins me now. Okay, wait. Marty, I've got to... This is throwing me for a loop. For the listener, let me explain. Marty Winston will send me out a list of different topics that we're going to record on, and sometimes he gives me detailed notes, and sometimes it's this. Literally, this is what it says. Coolest little components of the quarter. Richwave single chip radar. Marty, I'm sitting here, I'm thinking, okay, like the radar detector guns that the cops have that run like $1,000, $1,500, what are we talking about here?
We're talking about a chip so small that if you were to stack up four or five of them, they'd be the size of a kernel of corn.
Well, wait a second.
A complete radar, well, it's complete as an interface, a complete radar on a chip. It needs an antenna, which is only a printed circuit pattern. Richwave, R-I-C-H-W-A-V-E, has more than one kind. And the kind that I love has continuous wave in addition to the usual the time of flight stuff going on. So it can tell you the range to something. It can tell you if it's moving. It can also tell you if there's anything there.
Okay, so we're talking about something, so you're saying single chip radar. So this is kind of like the single board computing, like the Raspis and stuff
smaller,
like that.
Smaller.
But on a very small scale.
It's like a LiDAR. It's like a proximity camera, like passive infrared, but a lot smarter. And in production quantities, it's just a couple of bucks.
Well, a couple of dollars? Okay.
This top of the line one, if you're doing like 50,000 pieces, might be $2.50. And this one, you configure this thing, and you've got 360 degrees of coverage horizontally, and there's a wedge, a 50-degree height wedge.
Okay, so some serious coverage there.
Absolutely, and minimal energy use. And the signal is not going to disrupt anybody. And, you know, for you guys in manufacturing, FCC clearance is a cakewalk. Now, if you've got something, and just think about everything in home automation you've ever dealt with, right?
And I've dealt with a lot. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Right. You've got something that can tell you there's somebody there, there isn't somebody there. That simple a decision.
Motion sensing is in the automation
world.
You
have to be moving, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Every once in a while, you got to wave your hand around up in the air because the lights went off. Yeah, I got it, yeah.
It has its drawbacks, its compromises.
Same place it's been for 30 years, 40 years, yeah. But with radar, okay, you could tell if something was going on in the room. Okay, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and you get to set the range of detection. So if it's too far out, you don't count it. You get to set whether motion is a factor in what you're looking for.
It's
simultaneously simple and brilliant and affordable and flexible. And for a guy like me who's hands-on with design, it is one of the treasured components.
Definitely.
Move ahead with. I'm loving it. And I've worked with LiDAR. Anybody wants to tell me about LiDAR, I love it. But LiDAR is either a straight line or a cluster of straight lines. ST Micro has a 8x8 LiDAR, which is a kind of a cone shape. Everything is so many degrees up, down, out, and anything in there triggers on motion and presence, and that's fine. But it costs more than this. And that's just a 60 degree. It's not full circle. You need 8 of them for full circle.
Yeah. So let me ask, what's the first application that comes to mind for you on something like this?
Well, as you know, I've been involved reviewing initially and to some extent designing anti-COVID, actually anti-every pathogen you can name, systems to take what's airborne, bring it down into a disinfection chamber using UVC light making sure nothing lives to exit. And that will have a radius of impact, a range at which it can pull the air in. So that limited range is a good fit for the radar. It's using a tube that is nominally rated for 9,000 hours, which is a year and another week or so. But if you know that when nobody's there, you can turn that light off. When it's not doing anybody any good.
Nice, yeah.
And now that year becomes 2, 3, 5 years, you know, whatever, depending on where it is and how it's used.
Sure, yeah. If it's in the office, I mean, right initially, you're looking at 3 years start. And then, you're right, 5 years because people are in and out of the office. They're not always sitting at their desk, stuff like that.
Man, how many other applications do you want? You know, somebody comes close to your car and it shoots them. That kind of thing.
Well, okay, maybe not that idea.
Well, a squirt gun.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Maybe extend from that. Like, I don't know, make a sound or something?
Yeah, you could. In fact, one of the largest factors that discourages burglars at a house is hearing noise inside. As they approach, if you use it to turn on a TV really loud, they think somebody's watching.
Or make a sound of a dog barking or something like that.
A dog barking. Why not? It doesn't make a mess.
There you go.
You don't have to walk it.
I always thought owning a dog would be rough. But I was barking up the wrong tree. This is radio. What can I say? We'll be here for a little while longer today. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. I love it. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation, Microsoft Office 365 Cloud Beginner Tutorial. Thursday, July the 28th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m., virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on cybersecurity. Thursday, August the 4th, meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, August the 5th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., online virtual meeting via Jitsi, and their website is acgnj.org. The Kingsbyte Computer Club has a meeting Tuesday, August the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. For more information, 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, August the 11th. Meeting time at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, August the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And their website is limac.org. Happy computing! Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.